for the Commander-in-Chief, the Nobel Peace Prize.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has this year decided to award the Peace Prize for 2009 to President Barack Obama for his extraordinary work to strengthen international diplomatic work.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee puts its credibility in play by awarding President Barack Obama the Peace Prize. Can the U.S. President deliver? All hour a conversation. Does Barack Obama deserve the Peace Prize? Why or why not? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 9th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. And if there was anything guaranteed to pull attention away from healthcare and Afghanistan, it was the awarding the Nobel Peace Prize to Barack Obama. We're going to be talking about that all hour. We have been hearing from Afghanistan vets and listeners around the country about the war, and we're going to bring you those voices and much more this hour.
But first, Douglas Brinkley, historian, professor of history at Rice University, author of The Wilderness about Teddy Roosevelt. What must be going on? You're a presidential historian, Douglas. What must be going on in the mind of President Barack Obama right now, do you think?
Well, you wonder if they had some smoke signals that this might happen a day or two early, but otherwise it had to have been a shocker. Usually the Nobel's given for a lifetime achievement in peacemaking or something of that effect, or for mediating something that happened within the last year. This seems to be an award given more for hope and aspiration of tone that he set on the diplomatic stage for the year, so it had to be a shocker at the White House, and I would imagine a lot of high-fives are going on now within the Obama family.
And tension about what to do next to make sure you could deliver on that prize. Douglas Brinkley, stay with us. We're going to talk about the historical precedent of the awarding of this prize in just a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, the White House says the president is, quote, humbled to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. The award comes as the president focuses, ironically, on the war in Afghanistan. He meets with his national security team later today to talk about a potential new strategy for the conflict in Afghanistan.
Reuters is reporting, Celeste, that when the White House was emailed about the announcement. David Axelrod, Obama's senior advisor, responded by email to the idea that they were shocked around the world, as are we, was the quote, as are we. So it was a shocker from Oslo. NASA has just crashed into the moon. That's not a shocker. It was an intentional smash-up with the goal of kicking up dust so researchers can look for signs of water there. In Pakistan, at least 49 are dead after a suicide bombing in a northwestern city there. More than 100 are wounded. Pakistan's interior minister promises an offensive against militant strongholds in the region around Peshawar. Moving to sports, Tiger Woods now has a shot at a gold medal. Olympic officials just added golf and rugby to the Olympic Games. Competition will start in 2016. Wall Street gained a little yesterday. The Dow opens at 97.87, but we're talking about Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize. What do you think?
Hi, this is Pam from Bristol, Massachusetts, and I'm thrilled with the president's winning the Peace Prize. Not that he has created peace, but that the world does not give enough credit to the willingness to sit down and talk to people.
Well, credit, history, and the politics of the Nobel Peace Prize coming up. Send us your take at 8778-MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. President Barack Obama, the newest Nobel Peace Prize laureate, he won for 2009, quote, for his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples. We talked to Lars Bevinger, who's reporting for the BBC in Oslo. Lars was there when the announcement was made, and we asked him to explain the atmosphere, talk about the atmosphere in the room when the announcement was made. Was there shock and surprise?
Well, yeah, actually, there was not an outcry, but you could hear some of the gathered media actually expressing a surprise, because there had been hot favorites. Morgan Tsvangirai, the Prime Minister of Zimbabwe, was one. Obama, we knew he was nominated, but nobody really took it seriously, because after all, he's been in power for about 9 months and he hasn't had that much time to prove himself as a peacemaker. So, yes, there was genuine surprise.
And after a couple minutes, did it then change to feelings of congratulations, or are people still kind of in a state of shock?
Well, people are questioning the decision. There's been a Q&A session with the chairman of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, and he was quite pressed, actually, on the choice of the committee by several of the media gathered there. They said, you know, he hasn't actually done much yet. Would it not be better to award it to someone who has been working for peace for much longer and actually achieved something? Also, one criticism levied has been that Obama, he has a platform. He's got a global platform already, of course, that may be the best platform there is. While there are a lot of people in the background, if you like, who work hard for peace, who do not have that platform at all, who might benefit more from receiving such a prize.
That was Lars Bevinger reporting for our partner, the BBC in Oslo.
We want to give you a sense of that questioning that the committee chairman, Thorbjørn Jagland, explained having to really answer and justify this decision to award it to Barack Obama. Here is the chairman speaking.
Only very rarely has a person to the same extent as Obama captured the world's attention and given its people hope for a better future.
It's an argument that definitely had some sway with reaction coming in from around the world. Here's Mohammed El-Baradei, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
In less than a year, he brought a radical change in the way we look at ourselves, in the way we look at our world.
But there were also voices of skepticism. John Bolton, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, spoke on this program a few minutes ago.
President Obama's been in office for 8 months. He's made a number of speeches. There's nothing tangible that he's accomplished. So if the desire of the Nobel Committee is to reward effort, there's a long line of people who could get it.
Reports out of the White House this morning suggest that the administration was, quote, stunned by the announcement. Joining us now, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, White House correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Also with us is Douglas Brinkley, presidential historian and professor of history at Rice University. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, the report on Reuters suggests that David Axelrod said that the administration was stunned by this announcement. How did the president learn about it?
The president learned about it from his press secretary, Robert Gibbs, who called the White House shortly before 6 o'clock in the morning to inform the president that he had won the Nobel Peace Prize. And they were stunned. I talked early this morning to Rahm Emanuel, the White House chief of staff, who said that he had no idea this was coming. He said that nobody did. The only thing the president had been doing with respect to the Nobel Prize was writing letters to recipients, Americans who had won for science and medicine.
So we can confirm that there was no deal. We don't do the Olympics in Chicago in return for the Nobel Prize, right?
I can't confirm any private deals, but I don't think there was any deal. Rahm did joke that when he learned the news at 5 a.m., he said he told his wife, Oslo beats Copenhagen.
Nice. All right. Historian Douglas Brinkley, presidential historian. This is the third sitting U.S. president to receive the Nobel Prize. How are the circumstances here different than for Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, who you've written about in your own work, Douglas?
Well, Theodore Roosevelt won for mediating the Russo-Japanese War for the Portsmouth Treaty in New Hampshire, bringing sides that were at each other's throats together and getting them at least temporarily to lay down arms. And it was a very greatly deserved Nobel for Theodore Roosevelt. Woodrow Wilson got it for the Treaty of Versailles, for working to create peace in a League of Nations after World War One. The only other president to have won it is Jimmy Carter, as ex-president. He almost won it when he for Camp David,
right,
and mediating peace between Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. But he got it for his work with guinea worm disease eradication and election monitoring, all the great work Carter's done at the Carter Center. But to get it so early as Barack Obama has in his administration is a great boon for him, and you can only say congratulations. And I think there's some wisdom in the choice.
All right.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg, you were our partner, White House correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. You know, we spoke with Paul Martin from Columbia University earlier, and he was saying that this is a message from Oslo to Americans about the difference in perspectives, the way we view Barack Obama as opposed to the way the rest of the world views him. And I'm wondering, is that going to have any traction in Washington? Is this in any way going to help him get legislation passed? Will it have nothing to do with it? Or is this going to harm him in some way?
Well, I think that for President Obama, this award is actually a blessing and a curse, and I think that's why you've seen a relative quiet out of the White House this morning. It's 8:15 here in Washington, some 3 hours after the award was announced, and still no official word. I think Mr. Obama was subject to criticism when he ran, that he was nothing more than a celebrity, and I suspect that conservatives who oppose his efforts on health care and other policies will try to use this in some way to say, what has he done? What has he won for? He hasn't done anything yet.
Well,
but, of course, on the other side, this is a great honor. The Nobel Prize is not awarded lightly, and Mr. Obama is now in the company of such honorees as Nelson Mandela and Mikhail Gorbachev and Elie Wiesel, and one cannot help but think that this will give him a boost here at home. But I also think that there will be criticism for
well,
him.
Well, quickly, Yoshoge Stolberg, let's make a little news, possibly, if you can. Have they confirmed that they will indeed accept the award? There is precedent for actually refusing an award and saying, no, not yet, they'll come back in a few years.
Well, that's a good question. I did ask Rahm Emanuel this morning, will he go to Oslo to pick up the prize? And he said, come on, you know, basically saying it's too early. Don't ask me those questions yet.
Interesting.
We'll have an official word in a little while. I'd be surprised if he decided to not to accept the award.
Right.
They said that the president was humbled to be selected by the committee. That's the only sort of semi-official word we've had, and it came from a senior administration official who doesn't want his name used.
All right. Did Douglas Brinkley, presidential historian, did the Nobel Prize for Woodrow Wilson enhance his political clout on any of the aspects of his international vision?
No, because it came at the end of his presidency. I'll tell you who it really had a big galvanizing effect for was Martin Luther King, Jr., after he won the Nobel. You know, up until that time, there are a lot of people that didn't give him quite the respect or the credibility that he deserved. And then suddenly, he got the Nobel, and his whole life changed, King. And he became, he was able to mobilize the civil rights movement in a much more efficient way. I have no doubts that not only will Barack Obama accept this award graciously, but will probably deliver a very memorable speech. He's good at it. And remember, you know, he is kind of a global president in many ways, and the leadership people are looking for is what he's going to do in the next years on issues like climate, global warming, which is so very dear and near to the heart of Scandinavian countries, particularly in Norway, in Denmark. They're both those two countries are really leading a global effort on global warming. So I think the bar's been risen for Barack Obama. Now he's going to have to kind of work his way to prove why they gave him the award, which isn't such a bad strategy. And I just, again, think it's a great day for the United States to have our president win this award. And a hearty congratulations on air to President Obama.
All right. From Douglas Brinkley, presidential historian, the Reuters news agency is reporting that the president will make a statement at 10:30 Eastern time in the White House Rose Garden. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, in the seconds before we go, does this complicate efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan, or is this about something fundamentally different, his world vision and his international diplomacy?
I don't see that it complicates efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. As we know, the president's immersed in a deep policy review, trying to figure out how to pursue a new policy in Afghanistan, whether to send more troops or not. I don't sense that winning a peace prize, even if you're a president who's pursuing two wars, changes much in the way of policy.
Well, it's certainly something to think about. Very, very interesting discussion. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, New York Times White House correspondent. You got a busy day. Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you.
And presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, author of professor of history at Rice University and author of The Wilderness about Teddy Roosevelt. Thank you, Douglas.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some quick takeouts on stories we want you to be on top of this week. Louise Story joins us now, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. A quick takeout of concern to people with mortgages. Louise, we've heard a lot about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and their mortgage problems, but all of a sudden the Federal Housing Administration, the FAA, may now be in trouble. What's going on there?
So the FHA is something a lot of people hadn't heard of, John, because it was tiny for the last decade. It backed very few loans. It insures mortgage loans for lower income borrowers. But 2 years ago, when the housing market started tumbling, the FHA jumped in and it became the only lender in town. And to the point where we've got Congress people, there was a hearing yesterday saying we would have no housing market without the FHA. So it expanded dramatically. It's been making 6,000 loans a day. What it does is it guarantees loans made by the lenders, which is four times the amount it made in 2006. But as it makes all these loans, the question is it taking on too much risk? It is backed by the taxpayer.
So the FHA, because it works at the lower income bracket of the housing market, did it possibly exacerbate the subprime problem by focusing in that high-risk area? And does it need a bailout?
So right now they're saying it does not need a bailout, but it did offer loans to subprime borrowers to get them out of their subprime loans. And it's really been the only game in town. We featured some people in our story who've gotten FHA loans recently.
Right.
One of them was a woman named Bernadine Scheinman. She's a teacher, an English teacher in Denver, Colorado. And she could not get a loan from anyone. But eventually she got this loan backed by the FHA. And she told us, you know, when it came through, she cried because she could have a house. And this is the kind of hope that borrowers can't find anywhere aside from the FHA today. However, we've got a lot of people worried that they're becoming the new subprime.
Speaking of hope there, Louise Doria, shocker in Oslo, don't you think? Would you have bet on Barack Obama getting the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, one thing I wondered, and I don't know the rules, but I wondered if... people are allowed to turn it down. People are allowed to say,
they are
people
allowed.
Are allowed to say,
they
come back
actually.
To me in a couple of years, you know, so if I've
come back
done
to me
this.
In a couple of years. That's great. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. I can see you shaking your head as well, Ibrahim.
Now let's talk about some sports with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We have to go over what happened in baseball last night. Looks like the Colorado Rockies even things out. They're now tied 1-1 with a Philadelphia. St. Louis Cardinals 2 down now. They lost to the Los Angeles Dodgers 3-2 last night.
And a line drive to center field, base hit, and the Dodgers win.
And what's going on to the Red Sox? 5-0 against the Angels. What's happening in the playoffs here, Ibrahim?
So let's go to the Dodgers and Cardinals game.
It was a huge finish.
Yeah.
So
Matt Holliday, who had a big hit earlier in the game, he forgot the basic rule of baseball. When you go to catch the ball in the outfield, catch it with both hands. Don't catch it with one hand. And because of that, it was 2 outs, 9th inning. He could have won the game. He could have ended the game right there. His error cost him the game. And then let's switch to the Rockies. Yorvit Torrebella, he took a hanging curveball. And literally, if you were looking at that game and heard the fans, the Philadelphia fans were completely silent. There was no – what we just heard on the crowd in L.A.,
yep.
There was none of that whatsoever. I mean, Phillies fans get mad even when their team wins.
So, that's so right.
And then finally with the Red Sox – The Red Sox fans have to be happy because the Angels have never gone on to win a postseason series in which they've won game one.
Oh, that's grasping at straws, pal. That is to beat 5-0 and you find hope in that?
Well, the hope is that Josh Beckett will be on the mound tonight for the Red Sox, and that is the hope because he is their ace, and he's the guy that will guarantee a win.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is the Takeaway sports contributor.
And Todd Zwillick now joins us, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, I suspect with the Nobel Peace Prize announcement from Oslo this morning that a lot of sentences down there in Washington begin with the words, "So where were you when..."
Yeah, they might actually. People were on the edges of their beds or at their breakfast nook tables, I think, John. That's how this announcement came, because it, you know, started hitting Washington at about 5 a.m. You know, stunning silence from Capitol Hill so far, as I think people are waiting now for the president's reaction at 10:30 before they start to take positions. I've been blasting out and calling Senate and congressional aides on foreign relations all morning, and you haven't seen anything come over the transom except for background comments from congressional aides, some of which are kind of funny. You know, one aide said, "Here's the sound of my head. Scratch, scratch."
Todd, we've been getting reaction all morning, and it's breaking down either skepticism, "Hey, wait a minute, what has this guy done?" versus, "Yes, I totally understand where they were at." Here, listen to one voice.
My name's Richard. I'm calling from Oakland Gardens. They should have waited 8 or 9 years. And I would suggest that the Nobel Prize Committee say, oh, we made a mistake. President Obama was number two, and the winner is, and the name will be given.
So is that how it's going to break down, do you think, on Capitol Hill? Skepticism on the part of the GOP and the people who are, you know, working against Barack Obama versus maybe, oh, yes, this makes total sense on the side of the Democrats?
Yeah, I don't know that Capitol Hill would really break down. I think a lot of Americans are going to break down that way, and probably, you know, we've talked about the division between a foreign and domestic reaction to this. You know, people on Capitol Hill, regardless of party, still want to work with the president, especially on foreign relations, and still want to get things out of him. So, you know, a high degree of skepticism from Republican leaders are saying the president doesn't deserve it, I think, is unlikely. Now, what you may see if things don't go the way Republicans want is people to say, you know, it's fine for the president to win the Nobel Peace Prize. We congratulate him, great honor, but we need him on this issue. We need him to cooperate. Mm. We need action, not to artifice. And they've already been saying that about other things like jobs and the economy. So this might give them more ammunition, right in that regard.
Well, we talked with some people in Detroit this morning who, you know, were at this extraordinary event where they offered some federal assistance for about 3,000 people. 35,000 showed up instead, and the notion of a peace prize for Barack Obama seemed very far away indeed. On the domestic front, this is really a complete, non-starter. It's utterly irrelevant, wouldn't you say?
On the domestic front, it would seem to be. And maybe even in that way, a minus for the president. As we know, the president has been vulnerable to criticism of celebrity and image versus substance on a lot of issues. And this probably doesn't help that help that image one little bit on the domestic front.
Any good stories, even off the record, on background of, congressional staffers who, you know, kind of got a shocker this morning when they looked at the news?
Let's see. One congressional staffer emails me, yes, I spewed my coffee. another one, maybe the new standard for the Nobel Peace Prize is being not George Bush.
Interesting. All right. Todd Zwillick taking the bolts down there in Washington. Takeaway Washington correspondent. Of course, the reaction coming in all morning. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. What do you think? Does Barack Obama deserve a Nobel Peace Prize? And what will this help? End the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, or a broader sort of diplomatic initiative on nukes in places like Iran and Russia?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
So coming up, we're getting a reality check on the Afghan war from you and from a soldier. That's right after the headlines. And here are some of the top news stories we're following at 32 minutes after the hour. President Obama speaks later this morning in reaction to his Nobel Peace Prize win. The Nobel Committee says Obama deserves the prize because of his efforts to, quote, strengthen international diplomacy.
NASA has just crashed into the moon. It's an intentional collision that's expected to kick up dust. They can look for signs of water there. And in Pakistan, at least 49 are dead after a suicide car bombing in the country's northwest. That's some of the stories we're following this morning.
And as we've been noting all week, the accumulation of years in Afghanistan has been accompanied by an accumulation of voices.
My deployment the year in Afghanistan was the best year I've had in the Army.
Served in the United States Army for 4 years.
My brother is 29 years old. He is now in Afghanistan.
I'm 45 years old. I had never seen war. To actually see what war is, it was mortifying to me.
My boy was in Afghanistan and we're still trying to recover from that.
Definitely one thing that I will never forget is the culture.
I served in Afghanistan from January 2006 to January 2007.
My brother Martin, at the age of 57, joined the National Guard.
I was just really hopeful. You know, it was a mission that I really looked forward to. It was
voices from the home front and the front lines on Afghanistan as we note the milestone of 8 years in Afghanistan for U.S. forces.
We're going to hear more of your stories about Afghanistan, and to help us kind of put them into perspective, we're rejoined by Marco Reininger, specialist in the Army National Guard, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and a spokesperson and member of Military Veterans of Columbia University. Reininger served a tour in Afghanistan in 2008 and is expecting to go back relatively soon. We're getting calls from lots of military families this week. Here's one.
Hi, this is John from New Jersey. My son, John Jr., is in the U.S. Army and has already served two tours over in Afghanistan. When I asked him his take on a Afghani problem, he kind of laughs and says, from what he's seen out in the field, you're dealing more with 15th century warlords rather than the central government. And he said the U.S. will do nothing there until they realize this and start dealing with local issues rather than international politics.
And this question of how well do we know the Afghani people, it keeps coming up.
I'm calling from Detroit. I'm a professor here at the university, and my experience with this war in Afghanistan is teaching an increasing number of students who are out of the military or on leave and taking Middle Eastern studies courses. And the resounding message from them is the lack of preparation that they've had going into Iraq or Afghanistan.
So, Marco, you hear those two different voices talking about lack of preparation and not knowing who we're dealing with in Afghanistan. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I believe it's hard to prepare culturally and learn everything there is to learn about a culture like the one found in Afghanistan, which is hundreds of years old, older than Islam, really, if you think about it. So, and combined with everything else soldiers need to learn before they go over there. I mean, we have to fight a war over there. We have to build a nation, quote-unquote. So I think really the main lesson everybody gets is once they get there to really pay attention and interact with Afghans. And I think although we might not be perfectly prepared beforehand, once we come back, there's definitely a complete new insight into it.
We're putting you on the spot here, but I imagine you get a lot of analysis from people you meet who know you're in Afghanistan or have been there or on your way back.
Analysis
from people. I mean, they say, you know, why are we there? What are we doing?
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Absolutely. And everybody wants my opinion. And while I certainly have, you know, an opinion on the fight over there and my personal take on what it is we should do, I think it's just important that we, well, first of all, we focus on the troops coming back, you know, despite our political views or really our take on policy, we should, I think we have an obligation as a nation to support the veterans that come back because regardless of political standpoints, they've signed up to fight. And I think that's a very noble thing. And I think as a nation that progresses and openly discusses the war and is at a point, a modern point, where we can openly discuss war and our reasons for it, I think we should also understand that it is our obligation to support our veterans.
Marco Reininger is a specialist in the Army National Guard and served a tour in Afghanistan. So Marco, take a listen to this one. This listener says local knowledge maybe isn't as important as the new technologies that we have.
I think that we'd be better served to fight this war with more intelligence, special forces, and technology than trying to have all these troops on the ground. We're just going to suffer a lot of casualties, and we'll probably end up like the Soviets.
Can we replace troops with technological innovations?
Well, I think they should work together. The point of technological innovation and intelligence is a very important one. It's a great facet of how we're fighting that war, and I think it's one that works to our advantage greatly. The question is, how are you going to collect intelligence, especially human intelligence, which policymakers have stressed is really important in this conflict, without having an environment where you can actually insert people to collect that information?
And that's what you want to do. You aspire to be moving among the people in Afghanistan and seeing on the ground the real intelligence, not look at satellite pictures.
Well, yeah. I mean, it adds the human factor, which I believe, especially in a conflict like Afghanistan, with such an intense tribal structure and ethnic conflicts and just tribal structures dominating, I guess, politics and security over there, you really need to know what's going on the ground and talk to people and figure out what, well,
no technology for that.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Plus, in an austere environment like that and a landscape like that, how are you really going to find out where the people are you're looking for without talking to the locals?
I imagine one of the hardest things that you have to deal with is dealing with people who've lost someone overseas. This is a listener who called in.
I feel so helpless to put in my voice when he wants to decrease the American troops in Afghanistan. Please decrease our troops and bring the boys home. They're boys. My boy was in Afghanistan. We're still trying to recover from that.
That must be one of the hardest things that you have to respond to.
It is hard, and it shows how much pressure and how much burden there is on the families of service members, especially in the last few years where the operational tempo was very high and deployment came after deployment. A huge portion of the I guess, sacrifice was on the families, and as this man clearly shows here, it left its toll. So again, I think it's really important that we focus on helping these families, helping the service members when they come back. And there are great tools out there and great resources for helping these people.
Marco Reiniger is a specialist in the Army National Guard. He served a tour in Afghanistan. He will be going back there as well. All morning long, we've been talking about the surprising win of Barack Obama with the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize, and we've been hearing from you about what you think.
Obama, he deserves it very well. He is changing things. This is Eric in Detroit. He is changing things. It's not his fault. He stepped into it. Now he has to straighten it out.
1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Interesting. People are definitely weighing in. There's a certain amount of skepticism and a lot of real enthusiasm. You know how to reach us at mytake at thetakeaway.org. We've got lots more responses, which we'll get to in the rest of this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know, peace prizes aren't the only prizes being handed out in the last 24 hours. In our studio at this moment, for a change of pace, is the current 2009 Ms. Senior America, Gail King. Gail, good morning and congratulations.
Good morning and thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
You won the Ms. Senior America pageant last night in Atlantic City, New Jersey, correct?
That's correct.
Now, first of all, were you nervous? Did you expect to win? How confident were you going in?
I was thrilled to be a part of this pageant. And when I first heard about the Miss New York Senior America contest, I was delighted to participate. You always hope that you're going to win, but that's the icing on the right. cake. What drew me to this was the whole idea about aging and showing the positive aspects of aging as outlined by Dr. Mott.
Well, congratulations, and you look great, I may say.
Oh,
does Social Security get concerned if you put beauty pageant winner on your resume? Do they ask you?
Not when they find out it's inner beauty as well as outer beauty.
Well, a lot of inner beauty on display. Femi, okay, you're kind of the Ryan Seacrest of this event for us here at The Takeaway. You were there. What was it like?
At Atlantic City at Harrah's Casino, when I first told people I was going to report on the Miss Senior America pageant, I got a lot of very weird looks and a lot of bathing suits. Are they going to be wearing bathing suits? Are these faded beauty queens from 40 years ago? And the answer is no and no. What we saw, what I saw, 30 elegant women. Most of them hadn't even entered pageants before ever in their lives. And what they were very used to was the public's curiosity when they walked around in their sash and their crowns. They're very used to taking on the public's curiosity. So here's Tamara Swinehart. She's one of the beauty queens.
I remember I got out of a parade and I was walking up the thing that was going on around there, the carnival affair, you know, and this guy come up to me and he says, "So what year were you, Miss Wisconsin?" I said, "I'm presently Miss Wisconsin, but I'm Miss Senior Wisconsin." Oh my God. He says, I thought, wow, she must have been years ago.
She's like Miss Senior Congeniality there. That's great.
And also at the senior pageants, one of the things, and Gail mentioned this briefly as well, is that it's the public face of a charitable organization known as the Cameo Club. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a way of getting seniors to be active and to show seniors that they can have a vibrant, a glamorous, active life even when they're over 60. Becky Ross is Miss Senior North Carolina. She pretty much embodies the spirit of Miss Senior America.
I think in times past, when you were 70 years, I'll be 71 next month, and used to, that was old. Well, honey, it's not now. It's young.
Oh, that's great.
Are the restrictions, is this kind of an age gracefully pageant? Are there any restrictions on plastic surgery or anything else, Gail?
Absolutely not. It's definitely on the accomplishments of the women, their character, and what they can offer. And these women can offer plenty. They are talented. We were judged on not only the evening gown, but we were also judged on our talent. We were judged on our philosophy of life.
And I bet you had plenty to say, having your whole life, as opposed to these teenagers who, you know, get a little bubble-headed when they're asked the question.
Well, I taught high school English for over 35
years. There you go. Well, you can see 30 queens take to the stage in Femi Okeh's video report from the Ms. Senior America pageant online at thetakeaway.org. Gail King, congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much.
Ms. Senior America 2009.
Come sweet.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. This conversation about Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize is more of a flood this morning. Kathy emails us, the Peace Prize is sometimes given to people making efforts for peace, but of what significance is the monetary award? Good question. We're going to talk more about that later on this hour, but what do you think?
I think that we continue to award this president before he's done anything super significant. I voted for him, I believe in him, but I think we need to let his 4 years go up, maybe his 8 years go up, and then see what he's done, and then award him for his prizes.
It's probably something on the president's mind right now. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your take. The Nobel News is among the leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The White House says the president is, quote, humbled to win the prize. We're getting reaction all morning on The Takeaway. Earlier we talked to former American ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. He doesn't think the president has earned it yet.
I do think it's a manifestation of a politicization in the award, and I think the overwhelming bulk of the American people will say, what did he do to deserve it?
Well, we posed that question to former UN nuclear chief Hans Blix. He told us the president clearly deserves the award for his impact on nuclear weapons talks.
The climate has changed drastically, and mostly thanks to President Obama.
The president will talk about his award in a Rose Garden speech at the White House at 10:30 Eastern Time.
NASA has just crashed into the moon intentionally. They're trying to kick up some dust so researchers can look for signs of water. New economic data is out just this hour. A new report shows the U.S. trade deficit narrowed a bit. That surprised forecasters. Our partner, the New York Times, reports that another government mortgage giant may need a massive bailout. Not Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This time, it's the Federal Housing Administration. The FHA guarantees mortgages with low down payments. In sports, Major League Baseball playoffs are in full swing. In the American League, the L.A. Angels beat Boston to take a 1-0 series lead. In the National League, the L.A. Dodgers won to take a 2-0 series lead over St. Louis, and the Rockies beat the Phillies to tie that series at 1-1. Looking far ahead to the year 2016.
Why not?
The two sports that will be added into the Olympics, golf and rugby. They will be in Rio. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So President Barack Obama has won the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize for, quote, his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples.
And joining us again is Paul Martin, professor and director of human rights studies at Barnard College, Columbia University. So how does the rest of the world distinguish President Obama and his efforts from his domestic efforts? Do his domestic efforts even enter into the picture? Or for the rest of the world, internationally, are we just talking about how they see him in his global efforts? Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously they see him more in his global efforts. I think, first of all, they see this African-American becoming president. I mean, I think that's the basic phenomenon that the rest of the world is struck by. The idea that could happen is surprising to the rest of the world. That it did happen is, it gives a tremendous sense of energizing the rest of the world that the world can change. The rest of the world has a curious love-hate relationship with America. I mean, in some respects, they'd love to be here. In many respects, they'd like to be here. They see this as a very successful civilization. On the other hand, they also see it as an oppressive civilization in the different parts of the world in which they live. So that sort of ambiguity there. Now, with Obama coming to power, there's a sense now that this both of those can come closer together. And not, so to speak, such a tension between the two.
Well, let's pose this question of the love-hate relationship that the world has with America to the 2004 Nobel Prize winner, Wangari Maathai, a former Nobel Peace Prize winner who's been on The Takeaway a number of times. She joins us now from Monaco. Good morning, Wangari.
Good morning.
So, first of all, what's your reaction to Barack Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, I want to warmly congratulate President Obama and really say how excited I am that he has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Nominated? He actually won. So,
he won.
Wangari Maathai, in your year after winning the award in 2004, it certainly gave you a platform on environmental issues in Africa. What can the prize do for Barack Obama, who already has an extraordinary international platform?
Well, what the prize does, and I'm sure it will do for President Obama, is enhance his voice and also challenge him to continue his efforts of promoting peace and goodwill, of being willing to use his power, his enormous power, as the leader of the free world and the leader of the United States of America, to bring people together and to use that power more humanely rather than aggressively.
But Wangari Maathai, you know, you had done an enormous amount of work before you achieved your Nobel Peace Prize. Barack Obama, it's all in the future for him in some sense. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that it is important for us to remember that sometimes it is not how long you have been working. Sometimes you can have great impact within a very short time. And what we have seen in President Obama shortly after he became a senator, that's when we started focusing on him. And since he became the president of the United States of America, is how quickly he has been willing to extend the concept of inclusivity to the concept of diplomatic engagement, and to engage a lot of his fellow Americans that he dispatched to different parts of the world to seek peace, and as he put it, help to unclench the fist. I think that's great for a man in that position.
To what extent is the Nobel Peace Prize awarding him just for his election as the president of the United States, the first African-American president, and obviously a large change in direction diplomatically from the Bush administration?
Well, I think what we need to see is the many aspects that President Obama represents. First of all, he is the very first black American to be elected to that position. And as we remember, the whole world stopped to watch the elections in the United States to see what America would do with this candidate. And in many ways, when he won, the whole world celebrated. So he represents a real change in the world. And if that momentum, if that focus can be sustained, I think we stand at a breakthrough in the world for a situation where we could realize greater peace. And I think this is partly what the Nobel Peace Committee has seen and has embraced.
Indeed. Well, they said as much this morning, Wangari Maathai, former Nobel Peace Prize winner, on the line from Monaco, your home nation of Kenya, and which Barack Obama has lineage to, will certainly be celebrating this morning. You know, Paul Martin, professor and director of human rights studies at Barnard College, Columbia University, you know, it occurs to me that Wangari Maathai is identifying something that maybe we don't understand as well as the rest of the world, that Barack Obama has had an influence that in many ways in the day-to-day politics of Washington escapes us. What do you think of that?
I think it's absolutely true. I mean, I think none of the things that Wangari was saying is that Barack Obama's style is so radically different from the previous style. In other words, Barack Obama sort of says, let's listen, let's negotiate, let's talk. Let's respect other people. Let's engage other people. And I think that's the message that's got out very, very clearly. And that's very different from sending in the Marines.
I think it's good to point out that Barack Obama, you'll remember his very first phone call as president, was to the Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas. So perhaps this is a nod to his intentions and his platform.
And I guess what we're seeing is the Nobel Committee is kind of explicitly suggesting that what Barack Obama has inherited from the Bush administration, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, are not the focus, that it's more the diplomatic potential of what he's managed to accomplish in this sort of attitudinal way. That's where they've centered this award. Do you think that's valid?
I think that's valid because I think it's obviously they're setting a stage to some degree. And I think one of the critical issues here now is to say to the rest of the Middle East, this is the type of approach that we think will bring peace rather than a military type approach. And that's the big message.
Paul Martin, professor and director of human rights studies at Barnard College, thanks to you. And also Wangari Maathai, former Nobel Peace Prize winner in 2004 and friend of The Takeaway.
So we're asking all morning, what do you think of the president's win?
This is Eleanor Kaplan. I'm thrilled at the decision by the Nobel Committee. I don't know what their mission statement is, but it seems to me that this is a vote of confidence for what they want to achieve in this world.
Now, here's another take.
My name is Jan from Florida. It seems the whole world sees the value of what he's done and what he's inspired, but Americans are doubting this. I find that shocking.
And here's one more.
Good morning, Troy from Dakota. Forget about what we think about Obama's Peace Prize. How do you think Iraqis and Afghanis feel about Obama getting a Peace Prize when there are just as many American troops in those countries or more than when Bush was at the helm?
That's an interesting point.
We can always count on Troy to bring us down if we're up, yes, if we're celebrating. And Troy from North Dakota will always do that. And, of course, we want you to join the conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Even if you're Troy from North Dakota. Even,
yeah, we love Troy.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Actually, somebody on my Facebook page, I wonder if Barack Obama won this because he called Kanye West a jackass.
Anyway, all theories welcome. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway. And the winner of the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize is President Barack Obama.
For 108 years, the Nobel Committee has sought to stimulate precisely the international policy and those attitudes for which Obama is now the world's leading spokesman.
Surprise around the world and in the United States, shock, maybe congratulations. How do you feel about it? We'll find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 9th. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry.
Well, it was a stunner over at the White House. That's what we're hearing in the latest reports and reaction all hour to President Obama's receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for 2009. But we have a full show. We'll explore what it means for the new presidency, plus race and hair. That's right. The new Chris Rock film untangles the complex culture and politics woven into African-American hair.
But first, Paul Martin, professor and director of human rights studies at Barnard College at Columbia University. So, Paul, is there a huge disparity between how President Obama is viewed in the United States on some of these initiatives, maybe on his peace record? Is that different from the way he's viewed overseas?
But I think the problem with this in this country, when you look at Obama, you look at through Washington eyes. And what you're seeing in the paper every day is a lot of disputes and debates and biting at his heels, if you like. Whereas the rest of the world really looks on the outside and looking to say, what can America, as it were, do for the rest of the world? So healthcare is not a primary concern. It is a primary concern here. And here you sort of see him being pushed around by the politicians.
Well, is it different when you're pushing a Nobel Peace Prize laureate? Paul Martin, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, the White House says the Nobel win came as a surprise and the president is, quote, humbled. United Nations nuclear chief Mohamed El-Baradei won the prize in 2005. He says President Obama has been effective on nuclear talks.
In less than a year, he brought a radical change in the way we look at ourselves, in the way we look at our world.
President Obama will officially react in a speech in the White House Rose Garden at about 10:30 Eastern time. NASA has just crashed into the moon, we learn. It's intentional with the goal of kicking up dust so researchers can look for signs of water vapor there.
New economic data out just last hour. A new report shows the U.S. trade deficit narrowed a bit. That surprised forecasters. In Pakistan, almost 50 are dead after a suicide bombing in a northwestern city. And in sports, golf's greats will soon have a shot to get gold instead of green. Olympic officials just added golf and rugby to the 2016 Summer Games in Rio. And a new CDC study on H1N1 or swine flu says the virus is hitting a younger population than the seasonal flu. And that same report says some of the symptoms from H1N1 are different than those from swine flu. Wall Street gained just a little bit yesterday, and the Dow is going to open at 97.87. We're asking, what do you think about President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize win?
Alexis from Red Bank. I think you guys are really overemphasizing question of whether or not Barack Obama deserves to win the Nobel Peace Prize. It's a fantastic, wonderful thing. The man suggested ending the nuclear arms race to eliminate nuclear weapons from the world. That in of itself is substantial enough.
Tell us what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I talk about world peace all the time. I didn't get any prize.
You didn't get a call this
no.
morning?
No.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley.
My offer of a serious, meaningful dialogue to resolve this issue remains open. But Iran must now cooperate fully with the International Atomic Energy Agency and take action to demonstrate its peaceful intentions.
That's the newest Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Barack Obama. He was talking about the nuclear situation in Iran last month and his willingness to engage in dialogue with other countries around the world and to talk about nuclear disarmament with Russia are the part of the reason that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee awarded him the Peace Prize. Here's a statement from former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. He says, "I congratulate President Obama on being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize today. It's a bold statement of international support for his vision and commitment to peace and harmony in international relations, and it shows the hope his administration represents not only to our nation but to people around the world."
Well, that's one of a number of Nobel laureates who've reacted to President Obama receiving the Nobel Peace Prize on the program this morning. Wangari Maathai joined us, and also El Baradei has spoken, the head of the IAEA. But at the risk of raining on this global parade, we welcome back to the program John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador who served under President Bush, ambassador to the United Nations. So, John Bolton, the Nobel Committee is trying to influence things. What do you make of that?
Well, I think this has been a very politicized decision for a number of years. And I think it has been with a very definite bias. In a sense here, I think the Nobel Committee couldn't vote in our election last year, so they decided to vote this year. But I think there are two things that are noteworthy. The purpose of the Nobel Prize is to reward achievements. And if you look at the prizes that were awarded this week in physics and chemistry and medicine, they're all to individuals who have made a tangible step forward in their field. Here, at least what the press has reported about the citation for President Obama, it's for his efforts. And, you know, like lower school field day where every child gets a medal for his efforts, I just think they're debasing the currency.
Right, although there's always been an explicit distinction between the Swedish Academy, which awards for scientific achievement, and the Norwegian Nobel Committee, which has a quite different mission. We've been talking a little bit of the precedent of awarding a prize when peace efforts are ongoing. And in the Middle East, the ability of the prize to have any influence is certainly a mixed record at best.
Well, I think that's why it's evidence of politicization. I think the sharpest contrast is really quite dramatic is with this Nobel Prize and the first Nobel Peace Prize awarded to an American president, Theodore Roosevelt, in 1906 when he negotiated the Treaty of Portsmouth between Russia and Japan that brought the war between those two countries to an end. And I think observers at the time and historians since there have been essentially uniform in giving President Roosevelt direct and personal credit for this. So that was a tangible achievement. And in contrast to this, President Obama's been in office for 8 months. He's made a number of speeches. There's nothing tangible that he's accomplished. So if the desire of the Nobel Committee is to reward effort, there's a long line of people who,
right,
could get it.
Well, stay with us, John Bolton. Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Paul Martin, is with us, professor and director of human rights studies at Barnard College, Columbia University. There's also the example of Woodrow Wilson, sitting president, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, John Bolton refers to Teddy Roosevelt. Is the Woodrow Wilson example useful?
Well, again, the Woodrow Wilson example is a perfect example of someone who had a great vision and operated very well in Europe, but didn't get the support at home. And I think that's the challenge we've got to face today.
I was reading a newspaper out of Oslo in which experts on the Peace Prize were saying that they were expecting them to return to Alfred Nobel's original intent, which was to find a peacemaker engaged in a current conflict who would benefit from winning the Nobel Peace Prize, that they were trying to get away from lifelong diplomats or economists or climate change activists and get back to the original intent.
Well, I think that's a choice that they make. But I think that, when John Bolton talks about politics, I think, yes, there is a definite message to America. And I think it's up to America to listen to that. And I think that the previous administration is very committed to a go-it-alone type of politics. And I think the message the rest of the world is saying, we're here, we want to work with you, let's talk.
So, John Bolton, do diplomats such as yourself and whatever their political proclivities are, are they under some sort of do they have some responsibility to not reinforce cynicism in a situation like this? OK, Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize, but one could say for what? And the net effect of that cynicism would be to stall things that are moving forward. Isn't there some responsibility of diplomats to find a way of using this small gesture as a way of moving forward?
Isn't there a responsibility of all people to be truthful? You know, the at least in the case of Woodrow Wilson, he did negotiate the Treaty of Versailles. He lost it in the U.S. Senate by his own political incompetence, but he had at least negotiated the treaty at the time he won the 1919 Nobel Peace Prize. I have yet to hear anybody mention a specific accomplishment of President Obama in this field. And I want to say one other thing in response to your comment of your other guest. It's not the responsibility of the Nobel Peace Prize to speak to Americans to make us to listen. You know, they're supposed to follow the intent of Alfred Nobel's will, and they have in this instance, I think, demonstrated a very fundamental political bias. It certainly is intended to contrast with the Bush administration, but it's flatly untrue to say that we followed a go-it-alone policy. I don't know how you call it go-it-alone when we had 26 other countries with us in Iraq, when we created the Proliferation Security Initiative that now has over 100 countries subscribing to that effort to stop international trafficking and weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, but, well,
I could go on.
Sure, but John, I'm hearing
an important historical point to make.
Understood. But I'm hearing a certain personal sense of repudiation that, in many ways, this award to Barack Obama is directed at mistakes they believe you and the Bush administration made.
Well, I was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 3 years ago and didn't get it, so you could say it's at a personal peak there too. But I wasn't waiting for the call this morning. You know, I think it is.
Barack Obama wasn't waiting for the call either. I think it's fair to say.
Sure. But I do think it's a manifestation of a politicization in the award, and I think the overwhelming bulk of the American people will say, "What did he do to deserve it?"
Well, our takeaway correspondent, Todd Zwillick, down in Washington, says maybe it's the beer summit with Skip Gates
forgot about that. Well, that justifies it, of course.
All right. Well, getting out of cynicism here, Paul Martin, you are a professor and director of human rights studies at Barnard College. How does this help human rights specifically today?
Well, again, as I say, it's the attitude that interests me and sees very significant, namely human rights. I mean, what we're looking here now is a president who's saying to the world, I want to engage, I want my State Department to engage, I want my office to engage, and to begin to sort of try to recognize that problems are complex, but they need international cooperation. And this is going to take place in many different shapes and sizes and forms. But the thing is, we're going to listen. I mean, one of my classic examples was when going to Iran, coming back from Iran, going down to Washington, meeting with the desk officer and his boss in the State Department. Neither spoke a word of Farsi. That is not a base for communication.
So I guess the question really is now, what will Barack Obama's reaction to this be? Louise Story on the program earlier this morning suggested, well, is there any precedent for saying it's too early, come back to me in a couple of years?
And there is
precedent for that. John Bolton, what if Barack Obama does something like that?
Well, I think it would be a signal act of recognition that the prize is unwarranted. You know, I think it's going to be very interesting here in the next few weeks to see if the winner of the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize goes forward and authorizes an increase of 40,000 troops to fight the war in Afghanistan.
Do you think this affects that one way or another?
I don't know, but I think it demonstrates why the motivation of the Nobel Committee, as in a number of other awards in the past several decades, has been very highly political and intended not to reward achievement, which again I think is the underlying purpose of the prize, but to make a political statement, and they've made an overwhelming political statement.
But quickly,
this time.
John, this is hardly the most controversial decision they've ever made. The protesters threw snowballs at Kissinger when he turned up in Oslo to pick up his prize.
It's not a question of it being controversial. It's a question of whether it's deserved. I just want to hear what the accomplishment is in 8.5 months that's comparable to the Treaty of Portsmouth, comparable to the Treaty of Versailles.
What do you make of the charges that in the Middle East the awarding of a prize in the middle of a process had very, very little impact on Middle East peace, for instance?
Well, I don't think there's much of a process going on. To have a peace process, you need two sides, and on the Palestinian side in particular, there isn't really a reliable interlocutor. So I don't particularly think it's going to have much influence one way or the other.
Well, it'll be interesting to ask that question to Anwar Sadat or Menachem Begin. Not possible now. Professor Paul Martin, professor and director of human rights at the Barnard College at Columbia University, and John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, we have to thank for that lively discussion. Thanks to both of you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, the Nobel Committee in Oslo, Norway, has really set up an interesting tension between the way we view President Obama and the way the rest of the world views him.
Yeah.
President Barack Obama has won the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize for, quote, and this is directly from the award, his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples. This, as Americans are observing the difficulties President Obama is having advancing his own agenda here in the U.S.
Yeah.
Congress and in Washington. Listen to Mohamed El-Baradei, who's the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency in response.
Nobody today, in my view, who is more deserving of that peace prize than Barack Obama. In less than a year, he brought a radical change in the way we look at ourselves, in the way we look at our world.
So joining us now is Hans Blix, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The proposition on the table is what the Nobel Peace Prize Committee has suggested, that President Barack Obama has strengthened international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples. Give us a tangible sense of how that has changed your work, Hans Blix.
Yes, I fully agree with what Mohamed El-Baradei says, that the climate has changed drastically and mostly thanks to President Obama. He has accepted the conclusion that the wise fourth man in this U.S., Secretary Schultz and Perry and Nunn and Kissinger came out with, that we really should act on the fact that the Cold War is over. And he has agreed with a long-term aim of eradicating nuclear weapons. But he is also realistic. He says it may not be in my lifetime. And I think that's why there is plenty to do now, however, and I think he's also acting on that agenda. And concretely, he has started the discussions with the Russians about the continuation of a fundamental treaty between the U.S. and Russia. And that's going well, and I think we'll have results on it. He has also helped to set in motion the conference on disarmament in Geneva, which was stagnant and sleeping for over 10 years. And I think it's thanks to him that the discussions with Iran has started directly now. That's no guarantee that they will give results, but it was a hopeless format that they had before. So I think he has amply deserved, and I feel very optimistic.
Hans Blix, I can hear your phone ringing off the hook, as it must be for diplomats all over the world this morning. But
yes.
Doesn't this, though, represent a gamble that, in many ways, on all these initiatives you've cited, there are going to have to be results? Otherwise, the legacy will be one of a real lasting cynicism.
Yes, that's right. There are formidable forces and conservative forces against him, and cynical people say it can't be done. But the fact is that the Cold War is over. What can the big powers fight about today? They don't fight about borders, and they no longer fight about ideology. I think it's unlikely that they will fight a war between them on say, oil or gas. Yes, commodities will be short, but a war about it is unlikely. So I think it's a realistic view, and I think that the world needs to get used to the idea of disarmament, a revival of it. We have been marching for the against global warming, but it's time, I think, to march on to the disarmament agenda.
A lot of people trying to get a hold of Hans Blix this morning. So I'm wondering, you know, in these, if you say that the change has already occurred, that this radical change towards diplomacy has already occurred when Barack Obama came into office and with his efforts, did he need the Nobel Peace Prize?
Yes, I think that's the way the Nobel Committee acts in Norway. They want to give a boost to something that they feel is valuable for the planet and for the peace. And they have done so in the field of environment. And they've done so with an Iranian activist who fought for more freedom in Iran. So I think that's completely in line with what they're doing. And it's right now that Obama needs this, because I can hear hear the those who resist disarmament saying that he is a security risk or all these things.
Well, among those voices was on the program this morning John Bolton, the United States ambassador to the United Nations, former, someone who I know you know well. He was suggesting that, well, the Oslo Committee couldn't vote in the U.S. election, so they vote by giving him the Peace Prize here. What did they do here that they should not have done for President George W. Bush?
Well, Bolton said a few days ago, at least it was reported to have said, that he was not very far from Obama. Obama doesn't want to have any nuclear weapon state in the world, but he, Bolton, wants to have one nuclear weapon state in the world only. And I don't know whether he really meant it as a joke. I'm not so quite sure about that. I think he stood for an idealism in a way that wanted the United States to be the one who kept order in the world. And that was with good intention, but I think it was totally unrealistic that the U.S., that other countries in the world would accept this. And I think Iraq and Afghanistan shows that the U.S. cannot go it alone, and that there is no need for spending at the present time about $1,400 billion on military expenditures.
But are you getting some message from the awarding of this Peace Prize that Barack Obama is now under some pressure to end the war in Afghanistan?
No. No, I don't think so. No, I didn't mean that. He is in for a very difficult decision. I think many people are also worrying about the Afghanistan war, what turn it will take, and it will take very, very cool reasoning to get on with it.
So, you know, this prize, in Nobel's original will, it said it's going to be awarded to the person who's conferred the greatest benefit on mankind. That's the exact language in Nobel's will. And I'm wondering, has Barack Obama conferred already? I mean, we keep talking about the fact that he hasn't signed any treaties or negotiated peaces, but has he conferred already a benefit to mankind?
Well, he's given a new direction to the debate. And I think that the joint declaration he made together with President Medvedev in London, in which they said that we must put the Cold War behind ourselves. That was a very important signal, and they have got down to the discussions with the Russians about the prolongation of the fundamental START, the one treaty. I think that his decision also on the missile shield has been of very great importance. It's practical. The new direction they take is rather to protect against the missile attacks in the Middle East and the Gulf states, possibly against for Iran. But they never said that it was directed against Russia.
Right.
But the decision they placing of there that they were planning in Poland, Czech Republic, really soured relations and made the world situation more difficult.
All right, Hans Blix, former head of the IAEA, you've mentioned a number of initiatives that President Barack Obama has energized in his diplomacy. Anything that you see as the most likely to produce an actual treaty, an actual agreement within the term of Barack Obama's presidency in the last few seconds?
Yes, I think that, first of all, the START treaty is coming pretty soon. I think that the treaty, the comprehensive test ban treaty, is also one that he wants to have, and where the U.S. Senate rejected it in 1999, and it's on his agenda to get the Senate to approve it. That's not yet there, but if the Chinese came on, they are in favor of it. I think he would be strengthened by
all
that.
All right, we will let you go, Hans Blix. Okay. Busy day for you. Former head of the IAEA talking about Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize awarded today in Oslo.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we'll go to Detroit, where unemployment is sky high and help cannot get there fast enough. But first, we'll check in on the top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Former President Jimmy Carter says President Obama's Nobel win is, quote, a bold statement of international support for his vision. President Carter won the prize in 2002. We've had reaction from all sides this morning, both supportive and critical of President Obama's selection. You can hear those conversations online at thetakeaway.org.
NASA has just crashed into the moon intentionally. It's a smash-up to see what's under the surface. The crash happened about 2 hours ago. NASA's Michael Bakay says it will take a little while to see the results.
Well, it's hard to tell what we saw there. I'm not sure.
At least he's honest. Scientists are searching for signs of water on the moon. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Fresh economic data yesterday was that new unemployment claims fell to just over 500,000, and that's the lowest level since January. So people like Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke see data like that and say the worst of the recession is over, right? But does this sound like recovery?
Hey, Come here. Who you guys have?
I got my application. Okay. My mom and my daughter.
No. There's nobody going in there. If I didn't see you come out in the first place, you're not.
You
going
did see me come out. Maybe you remember me. I had the black car. You said, "Don't go."
That's the sound of a police officer trying to bring order to a convention center in Detroit on Wednesday, where more than 30,000 people showed up to apply for very small amounts of federal assistance. They only had about 5,000 applications available. The scene became very ugly. To get first-hand accounts of what happened at Cobo Center, we turned to former police commander of that precinct, Gary Brown. Good morning, Gary.
Morning.
Hi. So you were there on Wednesday handing out water. You're also, I guess, handing out campaign flyers since you're running for office there. What did you see?
Well, I saw about 10,000 people lined up on the inside of the facility trying to get an application, or at least trying to line up and wait for the door to open at 10 o'clock and get an application. And then I saw the crowd building outside to where another 10 to 15,000 people were arriving.
For blocks and blocks. We're also joined by Cheryl P. Johnson, CEO for the Coalition for Temporary Shelter, who is contracted by Detroit to accept filled-in applications at Cobo Hall. Cheryl, take a listen to this.
Detroit is crazy. It's crazy. All this chaos is just a sign of what Detroit is like. Bunch of chaos.
So, Cheryl, there's, a bunch of chaos in Detroit. There is a gap between what economists are saying and certainly what the people in Detroit and other cities that were hard hit are saying. Are things getting better in Detroit?
Oh, well, Celeste, when you look at it specifically, I think in my last 20 years of working with some of the most vulnerable people in our community, I've never have seen anything or witnessed anything like I did on Wednesday. But when you look at the number of jobs in the last 10 years across the country that have been lost, and that's a 1,200,000 and something, 62% of that came out of Michigan. And so what you saw on Wednesday and what you just heard is really the desperate cry of people. I mean, anytime you have an 80-year-old woman who comes down in a crowd, and that crowd was something like 35,000, by the way, and with oxygen, or mom with a brand new baby and four children, it really does speak to the how people are very, very desperate right now, especially in the city of Detroit.
Andy Stentner is the deputy director of the National Employment Law Project. So, Andy, you're hearing these things about the scene in Detroit on Wednesday. Is Detroit a special case? I mean, there's now 5.5 million Americans who've been out of a job, who've been unemployed for more than 6 months. Is it as desperate as this in other cities as well?
I think it's as true from Detroit to Fort Myers, Florida, to Las Vegas, Nevada. Whatever signs of hope are just about things starting to get a little less worse. It doesn't really mean that there's any hiring going on, and that's what we need to make an economic recovery.
You know, Cheryl Johnson, what you were just saying there and looking at these pictures from Detroit really reminds me that we've had a couple of examples during this recession where the government opens up the floodgates to help people, either in terms of housing, in mortgage tax credits, or the Cash for Clunkers program. And this, every time those doors open, it's a mob scene. I mean, Cash
Absolutely.
For Clunkers, it's amazing. What does that say?
It says either there's a disconnect there, because the numbers exceed what really, you know, what people really think is happening. When that door is open, you see the reality that those numbers exceed what either the government is thinking is happening. And that was certainly the case. I mean, you've heard all kinds of things about, well, it was it wasn't thought out well in terms of the planning. But I think there was a plan in place to address the applications. However, when you saw those numbers, I don't think anyone had any idea that many people would turn out starting at 2:30 a.m. in the morning.
So, Gary Brown, if you were a former cop and you're now running for Detroit City Council, they actually had to call in 150 extra policemen to handle the crowd, and a couple people, I guess, were taken away in an ambulance. What happened to cause injuries there?
Well, as Cheryl said, I think the city anticipated about 10,000 people showing up, and I think that's the real problem here is that I don't think the state, the region, and in a lot of cases even local government can get its arms wrapped around the depth of the problem of poverty in the city of Detroit. No one expected 35,000 people down at Cobo Hall, and nobody certainly expected them to show up. I talked to people that actually got there at 1:30 in the morning. And
wow.
So the police department was prepared for about 10,000 people to show up around 6:30 for the doors to open at 10 o'clock. And when people started showing up at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning and creating their own lines, it created a problem. But the real problem here is that no one in the city seems to have their arms wrapped around the depth of the problem, except people like Cheryl that are in the business of serving the needy. I, too, sit on the board of directors of Mariners Inn, which is a homeless shelter for drug abuse men, and we see we know what the depth of the problem is, but local government in Detroit doesn't.
So, Andy, let's end with you. You are the deputy director of the National Employment Law Project, and I'm wondering, we have this headline news about Barack Obama. Is that really far removed from the kind of people that you're dealing with every day?
You know, I grew up in Lafayette Park in Detroit, and people can pick on it. But, you know, we've had a situation where we've underinvested in the safety net for the last 20 years. So none of the programs are really up to speed to handle this increase in demand. But there are 3.5 million Americans, depending on extended unemployment
right.
benefits. Because the president got ahead and passed
yeah,
the Recovery
and
Act.
For them, the headline is that they're still unemployed, I guess. That's Andy Stettner, deputy director of the National Employment Law Project. We also heard from Gary Brown, a former cop in Detroit, and Cheryl P. Johnson, CEO for the Coalition for Temporary Shelter. I imagine for a lot of people, President Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize is not on the top of your priority list right now. Maybe you have real-life priorities that outweigh that. Let us know if that's true or weigh in on the Nobel Peace Prize decision today, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. I wish it
was. In this battle against terrorism, there is no silver bullet.
And we're asking all the nations to join together to use political action, diplomatic action, economic action,
so much like an explosion.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes.
Like an explosion.
8 years. This week, that's how long we've been a part of the war in Afghanistan. And in the shadow of the Iraq War, it's one that continues, one that simmers outside of the periphery.
My name is Zach Barnes from New Hampshire. I've served in Afghanistan from January 2006 to January 2007. People are starting to focus more on what in the past has been called the Forgotten War. And when we were there in 06, we really felt almost like we were forgotten.
This is Mary from Mount Clemens, and I'm ashamed to admit that I really don't even think much about the war, except every Sunday our church prays for those who are serving, and other than that, a whole week goes by, and unless I hear it on NPR, I'm not thinking about it, and I'm not proud of that fact.
Stories of forgetting, stories of remembering. We've been collecting the stories of soldiers and the stories of civilians, trying to understand how each of us looks at and thinks about this war.
And how we each feel about the fight sometimes amounts to the simplicity of what we see. At home, the injured soldiers coming home, serving in Afghanistan, the Afghan people in desperate need of help.
Troy calling from Dakota. This is not an invisible war to me, because I occasionally see a 20-year-old amputee veteran walking the streets of my hometown, and I don't believe for a second that what we're doing over there is worth that sacrifice. Bring them all home.
My deployment the year in Afghanistan was the best year I've had in the Army. We had a little girl come in, and she had burns all over her body, and we took care of her the whole year, and she was my girl, and I wanted to bring her back to the States with me, and I think about her on a daily basis.
The story of Afghanistan is a story of people, people who are strangers, people who are loved ones.
I'd never shot anybody. I had seen some pretty heinous things, but I had never seen war. To actually see what war is after a woman runs up with a child who picked up a cluster bomb and you're trying to stick an IV in her neck, it was mortifying to me.
My name is Melissa. My brother is 29 years old. He is now in Afghanistan, and it's a really, really emotional subject. When it's your own brother, but Obama really needs to make up his mind what he's going to do, because it's very, very hard on their family.
And from the story that you've called, emailed, and sent in to us, there are some of you who hold on to that impulse, that no matter where you are, there's reason for hope, even after 8 long years.
This is David from New York calling. The war in Afghanistan can and must be won. And to do this, boots on the ground are needed.
It was a mission that I really looked forward to. It was really about helping the Afghani people and nurturing this growing democracy. I just remember vividly stepping off the plane in Bagram Air Base and this beautiful valley. And I really never thought that in my wildest dreams that Afghanistan, of all places, could be so beautiful.
Driving through the desert, stopping off in all beautiful places.
Your stories, your voices at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This week marks the 8th year that America's been fighting in Afghanistan.
This is Amy Parker. My daughter, America Parker, was born September 24th, 2001. Her name is America, and we've been at war her whole life.
And how old will America Parker be before the war in Afghanistan is finally over?
I wish it was 8 years ago. And every day didn't feel so much like an explosion.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, Chris Rock untangles the strands of politics and culture that are woven into African-American hair.
We got Chris Rock?
No, his hair isn't so
I was
interesting.
Excited there for
right
a
now, there's a here's a check on the leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. The White House says President Obama was, quote, humbled to receive the Nobel Peace Prize this morning.
Well, something I'll have to humble him, yes.
Lots of reactions coming in here on The Takeaway. Earlier, former American ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton, told us the president hasn't earned it yet.
President Obama's been in office for 8 months. He's made a number of speeches. There's nothing tangible that he's accomplished. So if the desire of the Nobel Committee is to reward effort, there's a long line of people who could get it.
We also talked to former UN nuclear chief Hans Blix on The Takeaway. He told us the Nobel Committee may have chosen President Obama in order to move current nuclear talks forward.
They want to give a boost to something that they feel is valuable for the planet and for the peace.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, also an award recipient, has released a statement. In a way, it's an award coming near the beginning of the first term of office of a relatively young president that anticipates an even greater contribution towards making our world a safer place for all. President Obama will give his reaction in the next hour. New economic data out just last hour. A new report shows the U.S. trade deficit narrowing a bit. Surprising forecasters. Those are just some of the stories we're following this morning.
Give me a head with hair. Long, beautiful.
Chris Rock's new movie, Good Hair, opens in select cities today. It's actually a documentary about black women's hair, full of plenty of jokes, I guarantee.
And the probably notion... no music from the musical Hair, I bet.
I'm sure that is true.
Absolutely none of that music.
There is a notion that there is some hair, especially among African Americans, that's just better than others.
What's your definition of good hair?
Somebody looks relaxed and nice.
If your hair is relaxed, white people are relaxed. If your hair is nappy, they're not happy.
Oh, God.
This October, Chris Rock will take you back to your roots.
Just yesterday, my daughter came into the house and said, Daddy, how come I don't have good hair? I wonder how she came up with that idea.
So is there such a thing as bad hair? I'm not talking about having a bad hair day.
Every morning.
But bad. Every... No, I mean like bad. It is bad.
Oh, right. Such a white person.
No, oh, Leeway Rooks is the director of Princeton's Center for African American Studies. We're also joined by Marvette Brito, an entertainment executive and weave enthusiast who actually appears in Chris Rock's film. So, Marvette, when Chris Rock first came to you and said, will you be in this film about hair, what did you say?
You know, I think I said and thought what every African American woman would have said is, are you kidding me? You want me to go on film and talk about having a weave? I was really surprised, but I think more importantly, I was thrilled that Chris would really, you know, take on such a compelling, thought-provoking topic, a topic that clearly is at the center of the African American community in a way that has often been taboo. I was happy that he would inject you know, that uncover the mysteries of the hair business that often separates us as a community. But I was confident that he would add a humorous twist that would allow us to really look at it, reflect on it, and not be, you know, upset by his discovery.
So, Noliwe Rooks, you're with the Princeton Center for African American Studies, but you also wrote Hair Raising, Beauty, Culture, and African American Women. And tell me a little bit about the fact that African American women, they used to try and keep it secret if they got a weave, but that's changed, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big questions that people always ask is hair still political? I mean, it's hard to walk around the streets of at least large urban areas and believe that somehow a weave, hair color, hair length still has the same significance as it did, say, in the 60s or in earlier periods where short hair was sort of meant you were kind of radical and, you know, long hair meant you were trying to sell out. However, the issue I think that this film is raising and explores to some extent when you have Chris Rock mentioning what his daughter said is she, you know, came in and said, why don't I have good hair, is really the divide now is between hair that's in its natural state and hair that is has been chemically straightened or, you know, weaved. You have to struggle. You have to struggle mightily to come up with cultural images that are positive of Black women, say cultural icons, you know,
who are
celebrity.
Wearing a fro, a natural.
Who are wearing any kind of natural hairstyle for the most part.
We went out, we sent people out to Crown Heights in Brooklyn, where there's a large number of Black hair salons there. And we asked people at the Ambiance Beauty Salon if there is such a thing as good hair.
You know what? I think so, I have to say. I think some hair is just more manageable than others. I don't think there's such a thing. I think people always want what they don't have. Like, for instance, people tell me how wonderful my hair is. Oh, it's so nice and full, but sometimes for me, it's just too much. Like, I can't deal with it by myself.
Good hair. Good hair is like, whether you're wearing your hair or you're wearing a weave or you're wearing curls or straight, if it looks good when you look in the mirror, that's good hair.
You know, Noliwe Rooks, I'm so glad you're on the program because, I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I was, frankly, just totally envious of friends who would wear afros. But I have to say, for me, it is a total mystery why there is such political significance to African-American hair. This has been kept such a secret from me, and I think of myself as pretty culturally sophisticated. The idea that this is taboo, yeah, I missed it completely.
Yeah, you know, I think recently Solange Knowles, Beyonce's little sister,
right,
was on the Oprah show. Because she had just cut her hair. She just cut the weave out of her hair. And, you know, if Beyonce cut the weave out of her hair, you would sort of expect her to be a trending topic on Twitter. Apparently, Solange, you know, ended up being the third highest trending topic, which means, you know, you're the most popular in the Twitter, you know, universe. And she was invited on the Oprah show to sort of show off her hair. And really, she just said she's a single mother, and it was just entirely the weave was running her life. You know, if she was going to work out, if she was going to go outside, all of it had to do with how would her weave react to it. So she wanted to make a change. I believe, though, that the folks who made that the third highest trending topic on Twitter would be African Americans for whom it's not a secret to us how hair still matters.
It matters so much, in fact. Marvette Brito, I want you to take a listen to what one woman at the Ambiance Beauty Salon said.
I can be broke, but I have to get my hair done. I don't play that. Even if I have to get up in my own kitchen, it's going to get done. So, yes,
it is
that
important.
Is, yes, I will budget on something else, but I've got to get my hair done.
Why is it so important that someone who is maybe struggling with other bills and things in their life still has to make sure they get to the salon and get that weave put in?
You know, I think it's a lot of it, sadly, may be insecurity. I think a lot of women, you know, really, in addition to them wanting to look good and that's natural, I think it's really about, you know, the way other people look at you, the way other people judge you. And, you know, because I believe that many women or a lot more women would wear their natural hair if it wasn't about the societal pressures that are attached to what we think, you know, good hair should be. So yes, Chris heard a lot of stories where women didn't feed their children, didn't buy clothes for their children because they bought hair. So it was really startling, and some of the stories that he uncovered will leave your jaw open, because again, it's all external beauty, and people made great sacrifices to have it.
So, Mariette Bredow, I can't resist asking you, on the day that Barack Obama wins the Nobel Peace Prize, you say to me that there are hair issues in that household as well as everything else that's going on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, it's the number one issue.
Mariette Bredow is president and CEO of the Bredow Agency.
Perfect.
And one of the weave enthusiasts who appears in Chris Rock's new movie, Good Hair. We also heard from Noliwe Rooks, director at the Princeton Center for African American Studies and author of Hair Raising, Beauty, Culture, and African American Women. If you want to see more on that, go to our website. Our producer, Noelle King, went to the Brooklyn Hair Salon where both she and Femi Okeh get their hair done. And we have video of Noelle talking about hair on our site, thetakeaway.org.
By the way, it's just coming out. It might not be good news for Chris Rock. Filmmaker is suing him and trying to block the release of Good Hair, claiming it's a copycat of her film, My Nappy Roots. We'll keep an eye on that story.
But today we're focused on the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize winner, President Obama. The choice shocked some people, but what do you think?
Is it April Fool's Day today, and I didn't know about it? Barack Obama win the Nobel Peace Prize after doing nothing for Iranian fighting for their rights?
Here's another take.
This is Mustafa. I believe President Barack Obama received the Nobel Peace Prize prematurely. I believe the American people would be more deserving of this award, and that we voted for him and put him in a position where he can potentially make a big difference.
We got skepticism, but that's not all.
I have lots of good thoughts about Barack Obama in every way. I think he inherited a big mess and he's doing a fine job. But I think to give a sitting president, regardless of who they are, a Nobel Peace Prize is not appropriate. I think it could hinder his movements in the future.
You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Have a good week. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. See ya.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.